I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. I'm a baby boomer, and when I was a teenager and young adult, my parents' generation complained that my peers and I were selfish and lazy and irresponsible. We were troublemakers, more interested in sex, drugs, and rock and roll than becoming responsible and settling down with a job and family. Today's millennials hear the same thing from the now grown-up boomers, even though millennials are the country's most educated generation and by some measures the hardest working. Malcolm Harris is a Philadelphia-based writer and author of a new book called Kids These Days. It's about the economic and social conditions that can make it tough to be a millennial. Malcolm Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett is a psychologist, has been studying 18 to 29-year-olds. This is a period he calls emerging adulthood to find out what they want from life and how they see the world. He wrote a book called Emerging Adulthood, and he's a research professor in the psychology department at Clark University, joining us by telephone. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Full disclosure here, I do not share that view of millennials who I work with every day. Jeffrey, let me begin with you. Where does this impulse come to trash 20-somethings?
Well, I've puzzled over it a lot because I hear it a lot, having studied this age group for the last 25 years. I think part of it is just a traditional sort of stereotype that older people have about younger people, that they're somehow not measuring up to the way the older people were when they were their age. I mean, as we all know, that's been a stereotype that's been around for a long time. But I think part of it, too, is that things really have changed in the last 50 years. People do take longer to enter a stable job in the workforce for the kinds of economic reasons Malcolm discussed in his book. And they take longer to get married and longer to have their first child, just longer to reach the sort of markers that we traditionally associate with adulthood. And consequently, older people who reach those transitions earlier see them reaching them later and decide that there's somehow something wrong with them. Actually, in my view, it's in many ways a good thing that they're waiting later. We know that when people wait until around age 30 to get married, they have a lot a better chance of staying together without divorcing than people who marry in their late teens or early 20s.
Well, let me pick.
And people are better parents in their 30s, too, than they would be in their 20s. So it's something we should be mostly celebrating, not entirely, but mostly.
Well, I do want to pick up on several things you said, but let me get you, Malcolm, in on the conversation because you're the millennial in the trio here. When you hear those criticisms, what's your response? What do people not understand about millennials?
Yeah, a lot of the ideas we have about generational relations go back 50 years to this conflict between baby boomers and their parents. And we've sort of taken that, as we have maybe with a lot of baby boomer culture, for culture itself and for how generations relate to each other. And so we think, like, that's how it has to be, basically. Every group of young people is the baby boomers over again. But the economic situations intergenerationally at the time in the 60s were very, very different, quite the opposite than we are right now. And so right now we have being young correlated with poverty, for one thing.
Because of debt, for one thing. The job market, something else that you write about as well. The idea that if you go to college and if you graduate, chances are you're going to have some kind of debt. And what are the job prospects that you have?
Absolutely. And the amount of debt required to attend college has escalated. The number of people going to college has increased because the wage premium for college has also increased. And that's been driven by not increased wages, especially for male college-educated wage earners, but by decreased wages for people who don't have college educations. And so it's fear that's driving people into debt and into college, and it's well-reasoned fear.
Well, and I want to pick up on those things as well, but let me go back to you, Jeffrey. You have talked about several trends in the 60s and 70s. One is the technology revolution, which we're clearly still living through, the sexual revolution. We're probably still living through that as well. The women's movement and also the youth revolution, that these were the really momentous things that were happening in the 60s and 70s that set the stage for what millennials are dealing with today. Can you expand on that?
Sure. The 60s and 70s were really a pivotal time in many ways for American society and societies around the world. And one of the key changes was the real acceleration of the shift from a manufacturing economy to what's been called the knowledge economy, where you have to know something other people don't know in order to get a good job. And that shift has continued to accelerate through the last 50 years. And that's at the root of a lot of other things. It means people stay in school longer, so as you were just talking about, people have more debt when they get out. It takes them longer to enter the labor force, and they're in low-paying jobs while they're going to school. It also contributes to them marrying later and having their first child later. So that's a big part of it. But the sexual revolution, the women's movement, and the youth movement that I talk about in my book are also contributors to this entirely new experience of how people live their 20s. It's just totally different than it was 50 years ago, and it's really totally different than it's ever been in human history.
Let me go back to you, Malcolm, and I said this to you before going on the air, having read your book. You paint a pretty bleak picture for what it is to be a millennial today, what the future looks like for you. Are you pessimistic about the world that you live in?
No, I'm not pessimistic. I think of myself as an optimist, but I think it has to be a realistic kind of optimism. If you look at, I think the defining characteristic of our generational cohort is this experience with the increasing rate of exploitation.
Exploitation.
And that's the divergence between average compensation and labor productivity. And so you have around the start of our birth cohort in the late 70s, early 80s, these two numbers, which had grown together throughout much of the second half of the 20th century, start diverging. And compensation just flattens out, and productivity keeps increasing. And the further along you go, the more that gap keeps growing. And so you have the situation where people who are born at the time, the only economy they've ever known is this uniquely exploitative current American labor relation.
And is this an economy without unions, without long-term jobs? I mean, the kind of security that people in the past, generations in the past, at least for a moment, perhaps more in the 50s and 60s, for a moment were able to feel that they could raise a family.
Yeah, and obviously those were not evenly distributed, and we had women's participation in the labor force was different. But those labor conditions where we had a scarcity of labor in some ways, where we had labor unions creating labor power within the market, that situation has changed a lot. And we have right now this flood of human capital that has allowed corporations, has allowed companies to decrease wages or keep them stagnant, even for those good jobs.
Does that explain the kind of problem we have today of income inequality? And do you think millennials bear some of the burden for that?
Absolutely. Well, if we think about income inequality as something that has increased over time, generational cohorts, as they go on, are going to have more experience with that. And so we have generational inequality both between generations and within generations that is at a high point right now. So millennials have less compared to other generations did at the same time. And also within the generation themselves, there is increased stratification.
And you're talking about the fact that there are, we should make sure when we're talking about millennials, we're talking about across the classes, across the income divides, and there are many of them, obviously.
Absolutely. And we have this, the Marxists among us call it bourgeois universality, this idea that the experiences of upper class people stand for the experiences of everyone. And that's very bad analysis. It's very dangerous. It's what we get a lot when we talk about millennials and avocados or living with their parents or whatever.
That you're saying that's really not, that is a tiny picture of millennials.
Absolutely.
Let me turn to you, Jeffrey, and picking up on what Malcolm was saying there, and you talk about the technology revolution, and it's true, it's a different economy today than it was 50 years ago, and I think a different economy even after the implosion on Wall Street that, you know, nearly took us down the drain. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I do think Malcolm certainly sounds pessimistic, and I think unnecessarily so. There is a lot of inequality in American society, and a lot needs to be done politically, in terms of social policies to correct that, especially in terms of allowing people access to education beyond high school, which is really essential for the knowledge economy. But there are a lot of good things about these economic changes, too. I mean, manufacturing jobs have diminished, but most of those jobs were horrible jobs, working on an assembly line, doing mind-numbing and back-breaking work all day long. And most of the new jobs in the knowledge economy are more interesting to do and less physically taxing. So that's a good thing. We just have to do a better job of preparing people for it more effectively than we do now, and really addressing the inequalities that exist right now in access to the education and training beyond high school that people need.
I mean, we have to pay people more, don't we, Jeffrey?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this obscene tax bill that's about to pass Congress is just the latest example of a failure to address the inequalities that are longstanding in American society. But as Malcolm said, they're getting worse. The gap between people who are college educated and people who are not has grown hugely with the shift to the knowledge economy. And right now, in terms of policy, at least on a federal level, we're doing very little about it. Some states are now providing a guarantee of college access for all their residents who meet a minimum standard of preparation. But we really need federal policies that address these growing inequalities.
Malcolm, you shook your head when Jeffrey was talking about the changed economy.
Yeah.
Perhaps people don't want to do backbreaking work.
Well, there are a couple things I'd like to respond to it. When he's talking about the wage premium for higher education and higher education access, he's not saying, but he's sort of implying that that's driven by increasing wages for these knowledge economy jobs, for new economy jobs, and stagnant wages for, you know, old economy jobs, and we need to get more people into these new economy jobs. And that's actually not true. That's not what the data shows. What the data shows is that these new economy jobs still have stagnant wages. And
what's a new economy job?
So these are jobs where we're talking about that require a large amount of human capital. So a new economy job, and I talk about in my book, good jobs and bad jobs. And both of these are still new economy jobs. So we have service sector expanding, jobs where you're interacting with people, jobs that are hard to automate.
Hard to automate.
And right. So we have hard to automate jobs at the good and bad ends of the economic spectrum. So you have people doing legal work, and these jobs are also facing threats from automation, but jobs where you're communicating with people.
Like we are now.
Yeah, media jobs, right?
Well, you know what? Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Malcolm Harris, who is our guest here in our Philadelphia studio. And he's written a book called Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett joining us by telephone. He's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University. Wrote a book called Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. And we are talking about how millennials view the world and how the world views millennials. And I have got a lot of comments I want to read after this short break. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
This fall, Fox presents a workplace drama unlike anything you've ever seen.
It took 25 years of work and sacrifice to claw my way to the top of this company. But finally, I'm here.
What? I know you're talking to yourself by the window, but I need a promotion.
I'm sorry, what do you want?
A promotion. And I don't want it. I deserve it.
Why? How long have you even worked here?
3 full days.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Who are you again?
The Millennials. A show that explores what no other dares to. Beautiful 20-somethings trying to find the success and love they're entitled to.
A skit from Saturday Night Live intended to skewer the millennial generation. Notice there wasn't a lot of laughter on that particular segment from the show. Let me read some comments here. One from Lynette. My daughter and her friends are far more connected and passionate about our world and society than the majority of my peers are. I think that those who blast millennials are those who are offended when millennials have the nerve to disagree with their elders. Comment from Mary. As a proud millennial, I find it frustrating to hear the word used in a derogatory way so often. Most millennials I know have tons of debt because they got a degree that's almost useless because finding a full-time and well-paying job is so difficult. A comment from Maureen. Personally, I think they are the future, but then millennials I know are doing important things, filling jobs that are fascinating, necessary. I am proud of them. So a lot of, a lot of really positive comments. Does that surprise you, Malcolm?
No, I think our conception of millennials is starting to change. We've seen maybe at the beginning of a tipping point in terms of our understanding of what that generational cohort means, and maybe millennials themselves getting the chance to speak and frame our experiences in our own way.
Rather than having someone describe you to yourselves, right?
Yeah, and a lot of that is bad faith from people who are making a lot of money off millennials.
How so?
Well, both in terms of selling us products, for one thing, but also in terms of this labor exploitation. If you look at there's the graph on the back of my book, on the back cover, that shows this divergence between pay and productivity. And the further along the line that you go, the more money that the owners of companies, of shares in companies, are making off workers. And so millennials are the most profitable workers ever.
Jeffy, let me turn to you. And it's interesting, those three comments were from women. And you talk about the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s and how that is, in many ways, not for everybody, of course, but changed choices that women have. And I wonder whether in this emerging generation or emerging adulthood that you write about, whether you think women, millennials, do it differently from men millennials.
Well, I think the really notable thing in terms of differences between young men and young women is that young women are so much more successful in getting a college education or beyond, or some kind of post-secondary training. This is true at every level of the educational system, actually. Girls do better than boys in primary school and secondary school, and young women do better than young men in terms of going to and finishing college. So they really are taking advantage of their opportunities that have opened up since the beginning of the women's movement in the 60s. And they're really excelling, at least early in their careers. There still is the problem of the work and family, how to balance those once people have children. And women are still getting the bulk of the responsibility for child care and household work, even when they and their husbands both work full-time. So it's not like we've reached some kind of golden age, but certainly it's amazing what's happened in the lives of young women over the last 50 years.
And why do you think that is, though?
Well, I think the women's movement made a difference, and the sexual revolution made a difference. The fact that now it's possible to begin an active sexual life in your late teens without connecting it at all to marriage, that made it possible for young women and young men to delay marriage until around age 30, as they do now, rather than feeling, as young women did prior to 1960, that they had to find a man or they were going to be left behind and not have any useful social role in adulthood because they were excluded from higher education and from the professions.
Let me get Tina from Coatesville to join us, and then Malcolm, I'll give you a chance to respond to her comment. And Tina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I am a professor in higher education in the public setting. And the one thing that I often wonder about my students is why they're not engaged politically, especially seeing in the 2016 presidential election, millennials had a lower turnout rate. And your guests are speaking a lot to policy implications, but not directly addressing that the millennials aren't getting out the vote.
Well, that's.
And I thank you for taking my question.
Sure, Tina. Thank you for calling into Radio Times. You want to take that, Malcolm? I'm thinking actually of last year's election. Of course, there was the primary and then the general election. But how do you respond to Tina's observation?
I'm going to assume, based on Tina's profession, that she's a Democrat. And
sometimes you don't know.
Not always. But if she wants millennials to get out the vote, odds are she's a Democrat. And the reason that is that Democrat or young people tend to vote for Democrats, tend to vote liberally at a high rate, as compared to the elderly who vote for Republicans at a high rate, no matter wherever you're looking. And the Democrats have this really bad habit of complaining about their base for not activating themselves, whether that's young people, whether that's racial minorities, whether it's women, instead of asking why this party constantly tries to attract people who are not its base rather than energizing its base. Right now, there's one Democrat who falls in the millennial cohort elected to Congress. We are the largest voting demographic in the country. So if the Democratic Party wants millennials to vote, maybe they should try running some instead of, 80-year-olds.
Is it up to the party, though, to run some, or is it up to millennials to decide to run?
I think it's in large part up to the party. But if millennials are not that engaged with the traditional democratic process, mm-hmm. with politics, I think it's because they see it as a sham, and rightfully so for a lot of reasons. Bernie Sanders got more votes in the primary than either Clinton or Trump, and that didn't make a difference.
Jeffrey, how do you see politics and engagement?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to blame it on the Democratic Party. I mean, this is true all over the world, that young people are less engaged in conventional politics than their elders are. But it doesn't mean they don't care. They're more engaged in volunteering for causes they care about, like things that are related to the environment and climate change, things that are related to improving lives for people in their community. So, they look at politics and they see a cesspool, and that turns them off, not because they don't care, but because they're idealistic. But the other thing I think it's important to take into account is that it's an age period from 18 to 29 when people change residences a lot, and, of course, the most of any time in the lifespan. So, of course, every time you move, you have to register again. And Republicans have made it a high priority to try to prevent people from voting, especially when those people might vote Democratic. And so they've tried to make it more and more difficult for people to register to vote when they move to a new place. They've tried to make it more difficult for students, too. New Hampshire just tried to pass a law that would make it much more difficult for college students to vote. So part of it is that we do a poor job in the United States of really allowing easy access to the right to vote, especially for young people.
Well, we are talking about how millennials view the world, how the world views millennials. And again, that's Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. He's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University, wrote a book called Emerging Adulthood, and he studies this age group from late teens into late 20s. Malcolm Harris here with us in our Philadelphia studio, and he's an editor, a writer. He's got a new book called Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. More comments, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of more comments here. One from Ty: like every generation, some are rock stars and some are just rocks. A comment from Una: narcissists? No. Any millennials I've met tend to be hardworking, helpful, educated, and hyper self-aware. Let me get Dan from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. And Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to touch on something that you had mentioned at the very beginning of the show, and that was how millennials are engaged, over-engaged maybe with devices. And there's another trend that I noticed and something I think points to all of it. The other trend is that there's been a big push to move back into cities, and I think there's something behind both. And that's the suburbification of the country has left a whole generation really seeking out community. And I think that what we see is now millennials create communities online and engage with them through the devices. And so both those trends, I think, point to that, some of the breakdown of community that the suburbification has led to.
Well, that's interesting.
And I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about that.
Yeah, me too. And let me put that to you, Malcolm. You live in Philadelphia. You lived in Brooklyn before you came to Philadelphia. Does that make sense, what Dan said?
Absolutely. And we have a process called enclosure, where we take these public spaces and we wall them off. Companies wall them off. They buy the space, wall it off, and charge admission. And that's what we've seen happen to community at all levels throughout our lives. And we talk about it in the book with regard to children's play and play places. And in New York, you have, in other cities, private children's play areas instead of playgrounds and such like that.
But there are public playgrounds. It's not like they don't exist.
There are. But what happens when the wealthy are better off pull their children out of those public resources is that they get less attention from the state because it's the wealthier parents who command more attention. And so then those public spaces become a threat, a menace, because they don't have the nice rich families anymore. And then we see things like the criminalization of children's play in public and being harassed by police. I would be really interested in what Jeffrey thinks about the increasing rate of arrest for young people and how that relates to his ideas of emerging adulthood.
You mean like zero tolerance, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, and that we have a third of millennials are arrested before their 23rd birthday, and that's a huge increase from past cohorts.
How do you see that, Jeffrey? Or do you?
Well, I'm not aware of that statistic, but I do think it's important to note in reference to the caller's comment that there's actually a real urbanization of young people that's going on right now and has been going on for a couple of decades, where young people are rejecting the life in the suburbs and moving to cities. It's really adding a lot of vitality to places like Boston and Chicago, and maybe it's true of Philadelphia as well. It's a nationwide pattern. They want to live in cities, partly because that's where the best jobs are, but partly because that's where people their age are, and that's where the exciting things in life are.
Let me pick up on something. I want to toss this to you, Jeffrey. I mean, this comes from Malcolm's book talking about how children are raised these days. I mentioned zero tolerance. There's a lot of focus and attention on performance. Millennials apparently did more homework than their parents did when they were in school. Do you see that from your perspective? And I ask that because I remember doing an interview a couple of years ago about a woman who wrote a book about free-range kids. She lived in New York and let her 9-year-old take public transportation by himself, and he did fine, and people went crazy. Is there too much control, anxiety, worry that parents have raising their children and perhaps even raising millennials?
I think there's definitely some truth to that. The baby boomer generation of parents really invested a lot in their kids. And it's important to keep in mind that this was maybe the first generation of parents ever who really chose to have kids. I mean, in the past, kids were just a side effect of sex. You had the sex for a while, and then a kid came along, and that would happen many times in the course of adult life. But with the invention of effective birth control, for the first time, people chose to have kids. And so people who have had kids in that baby boom generation mostly really wanted them and invested a lot in them. There is a lot of research showing that this is a very child-centric generation of parents. And, of course, there's the stereotype of the helicopter parents that are too involved. Sometimes that's true, but mostly the research says that it's a good thing for kids when their parents are really involved. And I know from the age group I study, the emerging adults ages 18 to 29, yeah, sometimes parents are overbearing and more involved than they should be in their kids' lives, and sometimes emerging adults resent it and try to tell them to back off.
Sure.
But the ones who are the most trouble are the ones whose parents don't care, either because they have so many problems of their own or because once their kids reach 18, they felt like they were done and they wanted to go back to enjoying their own lives. Those are the ones who really struggle, because it is important in this time to have your parents' support to get education and to help with making a transition into adult work, because it takes most of the 20s for most people.
Malcolm, you want to respond to that? And you write a lot about raising kids and what it's like in school and kindergarten and all that.
I think one thing we have to recognize is that the stakes for this generation of children are higher. So if we have expanding income inequality, it matters more whether your kid ends up on one side or the other. And so parents are understandably anxious. And again, I want to bring up this idea of bourgeois universality, that most people don't have a lot to invest in their children besides their time and energy and love. And so when we think about, oh, it's normal for this generational cohort to invest a lot in their children, well, that's driving all these practices and these anxieties where then working class parents are forced to invest things they don't have, time, energy, money, everything they have, into their children just to try and keep up with parents who are investing more in their children, and this normalized idea of parents investing more in their children that is driven by rich parents.
Do you see that as creating stress on families and stress on since we're talking about millennials, stress on millennials to meet those expectations?
Absolutely. And in my book, I talk about helicopter parents a little bit, but also this idea of vigilante moms. And these are moms who are mostly working class, middle class, who have to fight for their children as sort of a full-time job just to keep them at a normal level. Maybe they've got ADD, maybe they've got a reading disorder, maybe they just have a hard time paying attention in class, and it becomes this full-time job just to keep your child on the normal path. And these are not rich parents who have this extra time and energy to expend on this.
Do you think that's any different from a previous generation?
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, the stakes for quote-unquote failure were lower. You could, if you, you know, could graduate your child from high school, or if your child graduated from high school, you could be pretty sure that they could get a job that could support them and, in fact, support a family, support a life for them. And we don't have that feeling these days. And so those stakes are higher.
Let's take another short break and get back to our conversation. Again, talking about millennials, how they view the world, how the world views them. That's Malcolm Harris. He's a editor and writer based here in Philadelphia, wrote a book called Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett joining us by telephone. Again, he is a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University, and he wrote a book called Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Lots more comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking about millennials with Malcolm Harris and Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. Jeffrey, let me go to you. When you write about emerging adulthood, which is late teens into late 20s, in a perfect world, which does not exist, of course, what should and could this be like for millennials?
Well, it could be a time of great freedom because you have left your parents' household, or even if you've stayed in your parents' household, you're a lot more independent. And you don't yet have the kinds of commitments that structure adult life for most people, mainly marriage and parenthood. And so during your 20s, potentially, in an ideal world, you have a chance to really focus on your own self-development and do things that you enjoy, have time with friends, maybe do some travel, maybe live for a while in a different part of the country or the world, have different relationships with people. Really enjoy the one time in your life where you really will be able to make your own decisions and do as you wish before you make those commitments that eventually almost everybody does make by around age 30.
Well, and
that would include a social system that allows you to explore different options in education and work by making it so you don't have to go hugely into debt in order to get the education you want and need. The state wisely recognizing its own interest in preparing young people for the knowledge economy provides you with enough support to get the education and training you need.
An ideal.
That's the ideal.
Yeah. Would you like to live in that ideal world, Malcolm?
I don't think I would. I think that's a very individualist, culturally specific idea of what family and life are. And that's a, like, you know, mommy and daddy and Billy and Susie live in the suburbs with their dog Spot. And once they turn 18, Billy and Susie go off to Yale or Princeton. And
that's not what I heard. I mean, I heard that the 20s is a time.
Not what I said.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, no, but the family itself is you have the children who leave the family, went to attend school, maybe they come back, maybe they don't, but they're constantly disconnecting from the family, which is not what you have at all class levels. And we have now, I think there was a study out of Wisconsin where they looked at 10 public and private universities and undergraduates attending there, and they found 55% of them were contributing money to their family.
No question.
Of undergraduates.
No question. I mean, my question was really, obviously, that's the real world. I was just asking you about an ideal world. If you could create something where you could create a time where young people, young adults, could figure out things. And I realize this is a complete utopia, but go ahead.
But again, so I don't think it's ideal. The ideal isn't for me to disconnect necessarily from your parents, from your community, or even not to have children.
That's not what I said. You don't have to disconnect with your parents in order to have the freedom to pursue your own self-development. In fact, what I've found is just the opposite. Emerging adults mostly do pursue their own self-development while remaining very connected to their parents. And in fact, their relationships with their parents are far better than they were in adolescence. They say so and their parents say so. So they're not mutually exclusive.
Malcolm?
But the idea that this is free of responsibility, or that you don't have responsibility to your family, is not followed up by the statistics in terms of how young people are relating to their families. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I don't think that's mm-hmm. necessarily something we need to run from.
But the idea that young people are contributing to their family, I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, for some people, it's an absolute necessity. For other people, it's just the way that particular family works, as I understand you saying.
Absolutely. Well, and again, it's a culturally specific idea. Family can be a wider network of people, something mm-hmm. that you I don't want to mischaracterize Jeffrey's argument here, but I think the idea that childhood is a time, or the 20s, emerging adulthood is a time free from responsibility, or should be free from responsibility, or feature less responsibility, I don't think is necessarily a goal.
Jeff, you want to add to that, and then we'll take some more calls and comments.
Well, I've done national surveys of 18 to 29-year-olds, and I can tell you that 80 to 90% of them think it's a goal, that they think it's not only a goal, but a reality. They describe this time of their life as a time of having a great deal of freedom, and a time that's fun and exciting, and a time when anything seems possible. So for the great majority of them, not all, but certainly the overwhelming majority of them, it's a terrific time of life. They have stress and they have anxieties, but they really appreciate the rare freedom that they have in emerging adulthood.
And is that something, I don't know how old you are, Jeffrey. I mean, it says I can look back at that period of my life and I remember the stress and also have some regrets that I didn't do things I probably should have done. Do you, Jeffrey, have a similar view of that emerging adulthood for you?
Well, I think I did all those things you didn't do, Barry, because I did live in...
I did some of those too, but yes.
Once in a while, I think took an 8,000-mile hitchhiking trip. You know, I played guitar for a couple of years for a living. So, yeah, I made the most of it. But I'm 60 years old, so I'm a boomer like you. And back then, it was relatively rare for people to remain unmarried through their 20s. You know, most people in our generation took on those adult responsibilities pretty early. So I really see it as a good thing for this generation that they do have the freedom to wait until around age 30 to make those commitments to others and have those responsibilities to others that almost everybody wants eventually, and spend most of their 20s having fun and being able to live a life of their own.
Let me get Kevin, who's hanging on from South Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm actually calling because I'm a pharmacy technician, and through my career, I feel like I'm stigmatized because in my field of practice, there's not many blacks and there's not many men, and I'm a millennial, so I get the
you get the triple crown. Yeah.
Yeah, I get punched from every direction, and I represent so many different groups. And my question to you guys is that an anomaly, or is that something that a documented fact for a lot of people in my situation or bracket.
Well, you know, Kevin, let me just ask you a quick question. Do you feel lonely, or, as you said, you feel kind of stigmatized, but do you feel lonely because you are those three things?
I don't feel lonely, more so like I'm the representative for everybody, and, you know, as a millennial, a black man, and I don't think I can speak for everybody, but
sure.
I do at my job get a lot of millennial shaming. Like, for instance, I'm a married person. I've been married for 10 years and 30, but I own my own house through, you know, God mercy, but I still get called, you know, get the millennial slander, and I don't think that's fair. You know, I work hard. I work two jobs. My wife also works hard.
Sure.
Yet we're still considered a pariah to the older generation.
Well,
I obviously don't understand. Go ahead.
No. I'm glad I asked you that, and I'm glad you told us a little bit more about yourself. Let me give Malcolm a chance to respond. You know, as they said, self-described millennial, but doesn't meet the stereotype.
Well, and that caller's life path actually sounds a lot like, more like my father's, right? So I'm 28. By the time he was my age, he had three children. And Jeffrey would see the difference between my life and that life as an improvement. But the difference between the economy now and then is that you could make that choice at the time. You know, there were more jobs like the caller's job.
Although he's got two of them.
He's got two of them.
Yeah.
Maybe at the time, a few generations ago, you'd only have to work one and there'd be more of them, especially in the public sector, which has been attacked in the past few generational cohorts, especially for young black workers. And the paucity of those jobs that would support a family and a life for a young people, for a young person, for a young worker, means that experience is rarer. And you can reframe that as like, look, we don't have to have kids anymore. But some people want to have children in
sure.
their 20s.
Sure. Kevin, I really appreciate you calling in. And all I can say is hang in there. Let me read some more comments. An email from Fred. Great polarization of income historically does not bode well for economic well-being. Do your guests have a solution? There's a tweet there on millennials who might want to run for office, but the Democratic Party makes it hard for newcomers to get involved, picking up on something we said earlier here. A comment from Inger. Gen Xer here. I work with millennials daily. They're delightful, ethical, less materialistic, and more aligned with living their values. They give me hope. Let me get Chris from Cherry Hill to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So
sure.
I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 48. And I'm a knowledge worker. I work in the high-tech industry with a lot of millennials. And I do really enjoy working with them, and I find that it's an interesting and decent generation. But I do have to say that the gentleman that's in your office, you know, he couldn't even describe the utopia, because millennials, frankly, have been given everything. They've got instant information. They expect perfection constantly. And I think that is a source of their great anxiety. And frankly, you know, they want to eat out and drink lattes. And, I mean, the stereotype is somewhat true. So I find it very telling that you can't even describe a utopic world that millennials exist in, because frankly, I think they've been given everything already and they expect perfection.
Chris, let me ask a quick question though. Obviously you're describing what I think we can all agree would be elite, upper level, funded, if I can put it that way, millennials. That there are, like all generations, there are plenty of people that do not meet your definition.
That's absolutely true. And frankly, you know, I'm a little bit tired of being an apologist for being a knowledge worker and an elitist. You know, this last election has really, you know, magnified this, like, disconnect between the haves and the have-nots, or this, you know, perceived perception. You know, a worker that wants to go work in an automotive factory, well, damn it, you may be automated and outsourced, I'm sorry. But if you work in software, or you do work in professional services or some other knowledge industry, and you take the time to go get a master's degree, then more power to you. So I'm a little tired
sure.
of the complaining.
I hear you. Let me give Malcolm a chance to respond. You've been given everything.
We talk about being given everything and how much millennials have these days, but then we also have these narratives like the closing of TGI Fridays. And the reason the TGI Fridays closes is not because, you know, people get sick of sit-down restaurants. It's because they can't afford them. It's because the labor is so much of that cost that you're actually getting someone's attention. And so instead we have food courts, glorified food courts for young millennials. And these are food halls. And the food sounds really fancy. And maybe you're paying about as much, the same amount as for an entree. And you think, wow, millennials really have it great. They don't have to, like, wait there for a waiter. You don't have to. You can choose a lot of different food from the same thing. And you ignore the fact that you're basically eating in a mall food court. And that's the same dynamic. We have these experiences of exploitation, of worsening, then turned around and flipped for us into some positive by baby boomers or people in a different cohort who are totally ready to reframe it as, look, aren't you happy with what you have?
Jeffrey, we're almost out of time here. Just picking up on our caller, Chris, who identified himself as a Gen X, and it feels almost as if we've come full circle here about some generational resentment. I don't know how strong that is. I don't know if that concerned you or if that's just sort of part of what it is to be a human being.
Yeah, you know, it does concern me, and it's interesting how hostile he is, even though he says he likes the emerging adults he works with. And I think it's just a preposterous stereotype to say they've been given everything. I mean, as we've talked about, and as everybody knows, they have to work a lot harder than people did a generation ago to get higher education because the cost of it has gone up so much. And so they're much more likely than his generation was, or Marty, your and my generation was, to be both working and going to school. I don't see how you look at that and say they've been given everything. But let me just leave you with this last thought. I've described this prejudice against emerging adults, against millennials, as the last respectable prejudice. Because if you think about it, the sort of things that he was just saying glibly about millennials, about emerging adults, he wouldn't say these days about women or about African Americans, or, you know, it's become unacceptable in most quarters to have nasty stereotypes about people who are gay and lesbian. And so the last thing left, the last really despised group, is young people. And I think it's time that stereotype goes the way of the other stereotypes, where we realize that it's unfair and it's untrue, and it becomes unacceptable to dump on them anymore. It's not helpful. Nobody benefits from being ridiculed, and it's high time that we stopped freely dumping ridicule on emerging adults.
And Malcolm, I'm giving you the last word. You got 30 seconds. Sorry about that.
I'll take it. Okay. That process is not going to happen just by making our case. It's a question of power and intergenerational balance of power, and that's going to be a defining question for our society in the coming decades.
Because there are a lot of you, right?
There are a lot of us, and it's uneven.
And it's uneven. We're going to leave it at that note. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And he's a research professor in the Department of Psychology at Clark University, author of a book called Emerging Adulthood. Malcolm Harris, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. His book is called Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. He's speaking at the Wooden Shoe, 7th and South Street in Philadelphia, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.